You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 11th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, from Geneva and Damascus to Tehran and the Philippines, we'll discuss the day's top news stories here in the studio with Jeffrey Kaufman and Alessio Patilano. We'll also head to Paratissima, the fringe event to Turin's contemporary art fair, Artissima.
We are trying to transform in an organized chaos from a chaos. We want to help the artists to understand what is best for their artworks.
And we head to the Monocle Cafe to meet photographer Jimmy Nelson, whose new project documents the lives of those dwindling tribes still managing to live apart from the modern world. All that, plus music, and a look ahead to the rest of the day on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo coming up with me, Andrew Muller, right now. So, a great deal coming up in the next hour here on Aperitivo, but before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
The Philippines President Benigno Aquino has declared a state of emergency as relief workers say they're still struggling to reach devastated areas in the wake of Super Typhoon Haiyan. It's estimated the storm killed at least 10,000 people. 80% of buildings directly in the path of the typhoon have been flattened, with 4 million people affected in total. Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop said a medical assistance team is being sent to the Philippines. She also discussed financial aid to the besieged nation.
$4 million to the United Nations flash appeal, $1 million for additional food items, non-food items, should I say, which includes the funding already announced, tarpaulins, mosquito nets, water containers and the like, and $1 million to the Red Cross to assist in their disaster response efforts.
Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, has today met with Ahmed Al-Tayeb, the Sheikh of Al-Azhar in Cairo, to discuss the Palestinian peace talks with Israel. The visit is seen as an attempt from Palestinians to gain Egyptian backing in the upcoming negotiations with Israel. Abbas confirmed that Palestine's stance over Jerusalem will not change regardless of the direction the peace talks with Israel will take. Staying in the Middle East, and the Western-backed Syrian opposition agreed to participate in international peace talks in Geneva. A prominent member of the Syrian National Coalition, Adlib Shishakli, said today, providing conditions set out under the London Communique, Geneva 1, and the Arab League Communique are met.
We cannot attend anything talking about peace or a transition without releasing all the prisoners, also without opening humanitarian corridors to let all the relief agencies, the Red Crescent, the Red Cross, get to the besieged areas. You just cannot go to any conference without letting these people get the help they need.
The opposition said certain conditions must be met before the talks, which aim to end Syria's 2.5-year civil war by creating a transitional governing body. The opposition is about to approve a cabinet led by their new provisional prime minister, Ahmed Tumay. Military sources in Pakistan have said that the chief financier of the Taliban-linked Haqqani Network militant group has been shot dead in the capital, Islamabad. A Taliban source said Nazirudin Haqqani was killed in Islamabad while travelling in a car with a few other unidentified people. The source said the body has been moved now to North Waziristan. The top court in the Maldives has delayed the second round of the country's presidential election, prolonging the state's political crisis. Mohamed Nasheed won the first round of voting on Saturday, but failed to win a clear majority. The runoff was scheduled to take place the next day on Sunday, but the Supreme Court ruled it should now take place this weekend. The current president, Mohamed Wahid, has refused to stand down. Well, J.J. Robinson, editor of Minivan News in the Maldives, said the continued uncertainty will affect tourism.
This does have an impact in terms of travel advisories, and most of the visitors come on tour packages, tour operators. It's actually well recognized now that one of the factors that has persuaded Yameen and the third place candidate, Qasim Ibrahim, a resort tycoon, to actually go ahead with elections was pressure from overseas tour operators who were concerned about the instability.
And finally, a man from Singapore with an unusual superhero-like name turned out, unfortunately, not to be a hero at all, but rather a villain who consumed drugs and stole from his brother. Local media reported that Batman bin Superman, which means Batman, son of Superman in the Malay language, was jailed today for 2 years and 9 months for various offences, including stealing his brother's automated teller machine card to make withdrawals. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
A crushing blow for the science of nominative determinism there. Thank you, Jonathan Wheatley, for that. You are listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
And you are listening to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Muller. It's time, the time here in London is 18.06 and a bit, and therefore 13.06 in New York. Joining me now for the next half hour or so with their take on the news here in the studio is Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News, and Alessio Patalano, Asian maritime defence expert and lecturer in war studies at King's College here in London. Gentlemen, welcome both back to the programme. We'll start today with Iran, the ongoing saga of whose nuclear programme briefly threatened to be resolved this week. The dynamics of this conundrum have remained constant throughout this saga, which has now limped on for more than a decade, which is that Iran wishes to reserve its right to develop a nuclear industry, and nobody else is terrifically keen on a theocratic regime with a tendency towards apocalyptic rhetoric acquiring the means to make good on some of its wilder threats. So depending on who we choose to believe, there was an agreement, but it was either scuppered by, and rejoice, as all journalists are, for this opportunity to use the word scuppered, which I know is a favourite of the fraternity the world over, by Iran or France.
Right.
Who do we believe? What do we think happened?
It's really I don't think we'll know what actually happened until the history books are written. But you know, yes, on one side, we are hearing that the French came in at the last minute and raised the bar and said, no, we need more verification. We can't let them proceed with the building of this nuclear power plant because then they'll be able to create nuclear fuel, and we can't bomb it if they become a rogue state. Because that we'll spread radiation around, and the French said we've got to save the world from this. And then John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, came out and said, no, it wasn't the French, it was the Iranians. They just weren't quite there yet. But he remains optimistic.
John Kerry siding with the French.
Well, yes. You know,
but then he would.
He does speak French, after all.
I think also that we're looking at a situation where the drama, because you were talking about drama, so let's stick with the drama. I think there's two different dramas here unfolding. You've got the regional drama, the region where Iran is in, and the one that is among the sort of big powers discussing and debating the subject. And I think where the French come in into the intersection of these two realities in a way, because what they were doing, they were in part also voicing concerns that have been voiced by Israel. And in a way, you know, they're trying to address that regional dimension within the context of the big powers. But yes, this was something that happened at the very last minute. So you might wonder, you know, hang on a second, this was almost done. Why last minute you're raising the bar?
I mean, it is interesting. France has become so hawkish under Hollande and so such an ally of Israel's. Israel is the one country that will be pleased with the latest news. Israel has spoken, been very outspoken about this kind of rapprochement with Iran that's been in the works, and very worried about it. But other countries see it as an opening, and Iran clearly is making gestures. Having failed to reach an accord with the six superpowers, the or international powers, they did today have a small breakthrough allowing the UN additional inspection that it's been after on two sites. And that's being seen as a bit of an olive branch, an indication, listen, folks, we are serious. Iran wants to do business. Mm.
I think that's a very important point, actually.
Was the deal that was done today with the IAEA.
Absolutely,
right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. So the fact that they're allowing inspections, I think you're absolutely right. There is an element there that the raising the bar, in a way, even though it was not functional to the achieving of an agreement to the, you know, within the reasonable amount of time that one had been given at the beginning, on the other hand, is keeping the ball focused on this problem of, okay, there is here a component coming from Iran, an opening. Yes, we want to do... We want to negotiate the situation, but at least we have to talk about what levels will be acceptable in terms of our Iranian sort of nuclear program.
Has the key dynamic of this whole standoff actually changed in the last few weeks? Because it's always struck me that Iran knows very, very well that nobody wants a war with Iran, which would be a hideous, expensive shambles with, you know, impossible to determine outcomes. So Iran holds the cards and can keep running out the clock in that respect, if I may mix the metaphor there. And the other country whose opinion really does matter is Israel's, who, if and when the crunch comes, will do what it has to do.
I think the answer to your question is more long-term than you phrased, with all due respect. I think that this is not a matter of changing in the matter of weeks. This is a process of several years' evolution as the Iranian economy has ground down through sanctions. Oil prices are still $110 a barrel, far lower than they need to be for Iran, which has seen its sanctions cut its output almost by half. The Iranian government depends on oil for so much of its revenue, and having lost half of its income from oil sales through these sanctions, it is crippled. It simply cannot continue to function. Combine that with a slightly more moderate leadership in Iran, and there is an awareness that unless you want to really destroy your country, we've got to do something. And the thing I think that people don't really appreciate about Iran is that it's about 70 million people. After Egypt, it's the second largest country in the Arab world. And that's, you know, it's a major, major player, more than twice the size of Syria. Mm. And isolated as it is, that's a lot of mouths to feed. It's a lot of people to keep from being restive.
Yes, you know, and I think the point about the long-term game that one is playing here is really important to re-emphasize. And I think in this respect, you know, let me wear my pro-European powers hat for a few seconds, right?
Please.
And you know, let's think for a second the fact that perhaps what the French, I mean, in some reporting in the news was underlined the fact that while the French were possibly the only ones really seriously voiced their concerns about the situation, they weren't alone there. And perhaps there was an element in you know, on behalf of the Obama administration to really try to cut a deal as soon as possible. Because, you know, we could make an argument that Hollande has been very proactive, right, in terms of foreign policy lately. But you could say that insofar as Iran and Syria are concerned, that over the past few months, the Obama administration has been a little bit, you know, walking on a shaky ground. And they have to be seen as they're kind of like recovering from that. So trying to push for a negotiation that ends somewhere quickly might help contribute, sort of bring that element of power and prestige back, but it might not be useful to the long-term game that you just mentioned, which I think is important.
You talk about a long-term game, but is there a long-term game? Because if Iran is, despite its protest to the contrary, still moving towards a state where it can build a nuclear weapon, then it is governing the timescale of this.
I think the question really for Iran is how to make this rapprochement while saving face and mollifying its concerns. I don't think it's about their aspirations to build a nuclear weapon at this point. I certainly don't think under this current, the newest leadership, that's a priority. I think right now they have obviously an incredibly strong anti-Western constituency that they have to somehow mollify. They can't be seen to be acquiescing. And I think that's the delicate line that they're trying to walk here. I should note that after that the UK just agreed today to exchange a chargé d'affaires to reopen, essentially begin to reopen its embassy in Tehran, and Tehran will be sending an emissary here. Again, another signal of a kind of Western softening, just ever so slightly. But I think the trend line is still moving in this direction.
Absolutely.
The P5 plus one are due to meet again later this month, I think starting on November 20th. Are there any grounds for optimism whatsoever, or are we going to be sitting here having this conversation again in a couple of weeks?
Well, we might as well, you know, and that would be fun, just as it
that's
is now.
Because it keeps honestly, us employed.
Exactly. You know, it makes us all, you know, very, very intelligent and look smart every 2 weeks. So that's fine. No, but I think the important point is that the negotiation of, I think, trying to strike a deal as to the amount of stockpiles and the level and, you know, keeping the program under control is definitely what the Iranians seem to be happy to talk about. And I think precisely for the reasons that you mentioned moments ago, we're talking about a very large state with a very large young population. And, you know, what they're looking at is creating the foundations for a sustainable, viable sort of state that can offer better opportunities. So I think at this stage, really, this is a more negotiating card. It's one of those bargaining chips. It's very important to keep.
To the extent that you can generalise about those 70 million Iranians, how popular or otherwise would a nuclear-armed Iran be with them? Because I can remember quite well being in Pakistan in 1998 at around the period they tested their first nuclear weapon. And it was my first visit to Pakistan, and I did try making the obvious point to a few people, which you didn't need to look terribly far outside your hotel to see perhaps more urgent spending priorities than nuclear weapons. But it was incredibly popular among Pakistanis.
True, but at the same time, wouldn't you say that the Indo-Pakistani relationship had a lot to do with that?
And you think Iran's not a little bit paranoid and tetchy about various other countries in the world?
Well, that's true. But at the same time, it's less of an isolated situation that it was, you know, the South Asian, the subcontinental sort of security dynamics there. Whereas, you know, in Iran is in the middle of a series of relatively complex sort of regional landscape. I'm not saying that there are components, the far right wing with the strong religious sort of upbringing, that are paranoid about things. All I'm saying is that there is perhaps a much sort of the complexity of the landscape lean itself to a variety of views about it.
You know, one of the things that does come up, and you have to look at this, there's been some interesting writing about this of late, that one of the reasons Iran has got its back to the wall with oil is because of the massive growth of fracking in the U.S. Mm. The U.S. is producing an extra 2 million barrels a day. And that's a staggering amount of oil that doesn't have to come from the international market, which allows the sanctions in Iran against Iran to be that much more effective. And it's something that the oil producers in the Middle East had no reason to anticipate. Saudi Arabia has upped its production also by another million barrels to compensate for the sanctions. But nonetheless, the U.S. is not as desperate for international oil. And that does give Iran just a much weaker hand to bargain with.
Okay, well, let's move along now to Syria on the subject of hardy perennials of the Middle East, where the opposition, or at least that portion of the opposition which has got itself together to get some letterheaded stationery printed, has agreed to turn up for peace talks. They have imposed some conditions. They want access to relief agencies to Syria's devastated cities, the release of political detainees held by the regime, and an assurance that Bashar al-Assad will be required to seek alternative employment. Now, Syria's government has insisted there be no preconditions. That all sounds a lot like preconditions.
Well, I think that is preconditions, isn't it? Yeah, I'm qualified as a preconditions, you know. Particularly insofar as the humanitarian assistance to be able to reach out to the besieged areas, and the fact that Assad wouldn't be part of any type of future scenario. That seems to be the conditions for the national coalition to be part of the process, which of course raises a number of questions about whether this will go anywhere anyway.
I mean, the strand of the opposition appearing at these talks is the Syrian National Coalition. Is are we looking at here at the Syrian equivalent of the Iraqi National Congress?
No, it's much more fractured. A bunch of guys
in suits that nobody in the actual country has ever heard of.
Well, if that's what you're asking, yes. Yeah. But I mean, I think that the problem that they face in Syria, there are a couple of issues that have changed recently. One is that the reluctance of the West to intervene has given Assad a much stronger hand. And so that has dispirited the coalition because, or the opposition.
Because Assad has learnt this for definite in the last few months, hasn't
he? Well,
he
sure
has. The West does not want to get into this at all.
Listen, Obama was ready to press the button and you know, and pulled back, you know, 5 seconds before countdown. And you know, and that has really dispirited the rebels, the opposition, whatever you want to call them. But part of the reason there's a reluctance to support the opposition in Syria is that it is very divided. It includes extremist elements that are not friendly to the West, and it too has been responsible some elements of it for serious human rights atrocities. And so it's not a clean divide here. Mm. And Assad is now in a position to capitalize that. On that, the opposition, the smarter members, have to be aware that their hand is now weaker, and so under great pressure from the U.S. and the U.K., they've agreed to these talks with these preconditions. I wouldn't put a lot into it. I think that my prediction is that we're going to be talking about this stalemate in the civil war in Syria a year from now.
Yes,
is this conference then, Alessio? Is the reality is that this is the West putting on a conference so it could say, look, we're doing something, in the hope of occluding the reality that no.
You are a cynical man.
Yes.
Well, just in the hope of occluding the reality that no one actually wants to do anything about this.
No, I think one of the good things is that, you know, whenever I always love to be on a show with Andrew because it makes me look extremely positive and optimistic
really,
about things. That's great, yeah. Honestly, you know, thank you. But no, I mean, again, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I'm wearing again my European hat, and I must admit that the Russians' argument, the Russians' sort of position in this kind of has a point. You know, it's not that they like Assad particularly, it's just that any other alternative looks really gloomy. And this is the reason why we're not going anywhere, and we're unlikely to see the situation evolving in a particular fashion within a year time. I completely agree with you. And I agree with what you were saying, that it does this look as we're putting up a show? No, I think we're trying to get a better understanding of whether options, alternative options, can actually emerge. But I'm not sure we're getting there.
I think if we hop back to our first discussion about Iran, I think one of the interesting things would be if Iran does create, we do see a rapprochement with the West and Iran over the next 6 months, a year, that does take some of the fire out of the Syrian uprising, and it would be interesting to see the consequences of that. But there are a lot of ifs before we get there.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Aperitivo Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. I'm here with Jeffrey Kaufman and Alessio Patalano. When we return, we'll head to the Philippines.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavors of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me is Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News, and Alessio Patalano from the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Let's turn now to the Philippines, deluged last week by Typhoon Haiyan, which may be the most powerful storm ever to have made landfall. The situation on the ground now is inevitably somewhat confused, but estimates of the death toll run into the thousands, and several towns in the central provinces of Leyte and Samar appear to have been partially or entirely destroyed. President Benigno Aquino has declared a state of national calamity. Listeners who'd like to help him and his country out can donate via their local Red Cross website. Alessio, you spent time in Japan in 2011. Jeffrey, you were in Haiti following the earthquake. What can we learn from What can we learn, I guess, about the difference that first world infrastructure makes in confronting a disaster of this magnitude?
It's not even first world. I mean, I think that you can look at India recently when the huge typhoon was hitting the coast. They had mass evacuations, very small death toll, and really, for a country that is so poor, did very well. It really is a function of what kind of government you have and how effective it is. Haiti, one of the most broken, failed states on the planet, was just incapable of responding and in every way squandered not only the short-term opportunities to help people who desperately needed it, but the long-term opportunities to rebuild a country that really needed to restart itself. But here we're just seeing it's wrenching to see these images and to think of the suffering and the extent of it. Clearly, the Philippines is not equipped.
A lot of the photos are eerily reminiscent of some of those iconic images from Japan, you know, yes. container ships which have parked up six suburbs inland.
Yes. No, I think here there's that is all true, but I think that one has to bear in mind that the geography of the Philippines in itself does not lean to an easy deployment of forces for the disaster relief operation. If we go back to 2011 when the earthquake and the tsunami struck Japan, one of the fundamental problems was that once you cut off the lines of communication on land, the only access was through either air or maritime deployment, which was not possible during the first days because of the debris and because of the the returning waves that made it impossible for the navy to get closer to shores. Now, in a country that has got a strong navy, has got all the necessary military capabilities for mobilizing, they still had major problems. In a country like the Philippines, where the central area is composed by small islands that are all connected together by maritime communication, if you have a typhoon, that seals off these areas and basically leave them to themselves. And that is part of the problem. You know, no matter how strong and how good you are in terms of capabilities that you can deploy, it would have been a very tough call for anybody, but particularly for a country like the Philippines.
So Jeffrey, when a complete natural catastrophe like this strikes somewhere as vulnerable as the Philippines or Haiti, indeed, what should be the first priorities?
Well, the first priority, I lived in Florida when I covered Florida and Latin America for 10 years for ABC and endured all those hurricanes that struck Florida in 2004 and 2005. The first priority begins long before the catastrophe. In situations like this, when you actually know something's heading your way, it has to do with evacuation and preparedness. Are you getting people out of danger? Are you mobilizing resources? And are you prepared to jump in the moment it happens? I mean, those are key. You can't have a successful rescue operation if you're not already mobilized and prepared. The problem that we're seeing is that this is such a staggeringly poor area. That the so-called hurricane shelters they were sent to simply weren't capable of protecting these people. And so, you know, we've seen some significant sized towns of 40 and 50,000 people wiped off the map. And they simply didn't have the infrastructure to prepare themselves for something. And as has been noted, you know, when you're dealing with an archipelago, it's not that easy to say everybody move, 10 miles inland.
Absolutely. And I think, in terms of when the disaster hits the ground, then the problem becomes how effective you are deploying within the first 72 hours. Now, I think that what we've seen so far would suggest that the worst is still to come in terms of, search and rescue operation and the number, the loss of life caused by the disaster. The type of mobilization was nowhere near the sort of speed and sort of scale that is required to address what we've seen there. So that amount of that massive destruction, so spread around a large area, would require a type of deployment that wasn't there. So we're still in for quite a bit of a hard time.
I think one of the things that comes up in these kind of disasters in developing countries is how effective is the central government, and these become a kind of litmus test for their ability to do their jobs. It was one of the astonishing things when I went to Chile, which is a much wealthier country and a smaller country than the Philippines. But when I covering the mine rescue, I covered the earthquake there in 2010, and it was extraordinary to see how how organized they were within hours. They were out repaving roads. I couldn't believe. And I said, I remember saying to, I was on the National Highway, Highway 5, heading down to the epicenter, Concepcion, and we passed a paving team. And I said, stop, stop. And I went and I actually went into the guy in the steamroller and I said, how did you know to be here? You know, this is still fresh. And he said, we have a plan. And the moment we feel an earthquake, we know we have to report to work. And I said, when did you get here? He said, 3 hours after the earthquake, we were rebuilding the road.
Gentlemen, we shall have to leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman of ABC, Alessio Patilano of King's College London, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to meet the photographer Jimmy Nelson, and we'll preview what's coming up later this evening on the Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily. But before we get started on all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Thank you very much. The Philippines president has declared a state of emergency as relief workers say they're still struggling to reach devastated areas in the wake of Super Typhoon Haiyan. It's estimated the storm killed at least 10,000 people, with 80% of buildings directly in the path having been flattened. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, has today met with the Sheikh of Al-Azhar in Cairo to discuss the Palestinian peace talks with Israel. The visit is seen as an attempt from Palestinians to gain Egyptian backing. Staying in the Middle East, and the Western-backed Syrian opposition has now agreed to participate in international peace talks in Geneva, provided conditions set out under the London Communique, Geneva 1, and the Arab League Communique are met. And military sources in Pakistan have said that the chief financier of the Taliban-linked Haqqani Network militant group has been shot dead in the capital, Islamabad. A Taliban source said Naziruddin Haqqani was killed in Islamabad. The body has now been moved to North Waziristan. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. Welcome back to Aperitivo, live here on Monocle 24. It's 22:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 16:32 in Rio. And it's time now to head to the Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street, a significantly more comfortable environment than those to which our guest has recently been accustomed. He is Jimmy Nelson, a photographer who set himself the ambitious task of getting to know 31 tribes scattered around the world, which had little in common bar the fact that various flukes of geography and history had substantially isolated them from modernity. His journeys and discoveries are recorded in the book Before They Pass Away. Jimmy is at the cafe right now with our news editor, Tom Edwards. Tom, over to you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Yeah, I am here with Jimmy Nelson, the photographer of Indigenous peoples, amongst many other topics, I should say. Jimmy, let's start by, I mean, Andrew was talking there in the introduction about documenting these tribal communities in far-flung places. Yep. When you are, in many cases, the first person, perhaps, to document these tribes and their lives, where do you start? How do you sort of frame your narrative reference?
Forgive me. Thank you for having me this afternoon. It's great to be talking to you. Not to correct you, but I don't think I was the first person. I didn't discover anything. Maybe I was the first person to document some of these specific individuals, but as cultures and places and locations, they've all been filmed and photographed before. I'm treading in the footsteps of others, but I am doing it in a very particular way. I'm doing it in a way that I feel will give them dignity. I'm doing it in a way that will give them pride, and I'm trying to make them into icons. I'm trying to give them the attention that we give ourselves in the developed world. So if you imagine you walk into a newspaper shop, and I'm going to exaggerate now, so please bear with me. 95% of the magazines, of a very the cover of the magazine is of a very beautiful young girl, 18 to 23, photographed by a great photographer with lots of light, lots of Photoshop, and lots of gloss. That's who we aspire to be. We know it's not true, because the 5% is the gossip magazine with the same girl with cellulitis, a fag, and a beer and a screaming husband or boyfriend behind her. But we aspire for beauty. We love beauty. We love beautiful women, men, cars, watches. But these people are, in my eyes, some of the purest, most beautiful people and things and places on the planet. And what I've tried to do is invert that attention we give to ourselves. And often we haven't necessarily earned it. these people have. And these people not only have earned it, in my opinion, we have to know it exists, and they have to inspire us to realize where we originated and how valuable they still are and what they still have to teach us.
Fascinating stuff. Let me ask you a bit about that process then, because you talk a lot about the truth of reflecting the truth that these people bear witness to. Does it ever concern you then? People say, "Oh well, you know, by simply observing these subjects, that observation already changes the observed." Do you worry that the truth becomes fractured through the lens of a camera?
It's all fractured. It's all utterly subjective. This is my opinion. This is my vision. I'm not an anthropologist. I'm not a sociologist. I'm a very passionate, very eccentric 45-year-old originally English photographer who believes these people need to be made into icons. It's very, very simple. It's my view. I'm very romantic. Yes, 90% of the pictures are directed. We say in Dutch, geregisseerd. I put them on a mountain. I put them there at 4 o'clock in the morning as the sun rises, standing on their fantastic horses with their amazing eagles. But I genuinely believe that these pictures will have far more impact because they're beautiful. It's very simple, and we like to look at beautiful things. So I started as a photographer when I was 18, and I spent a better part of 6 years working as a war photographer and a photojournalist. I was very unsuccessful, but it doesn't matter. I was very young, so I can forgive myself. And I photographed people as I saw them, but nobody ever looked at my pictures because we'd all seen them before. Now I'm making these pictures with a lot more life experience, having also worked as a commercial advertising photographer, so I know what works and what is aesthetic. Far more people are looking at these pictures, but in many ways they're of the same subjects. They're of the same people that I photographed and many other people have photographed before, but the attention they're getting because of this aesthetic, because of this beauty, is far more profound. So I stand 100% behind the way I've made these pictures. They're like sirens. They're calling you in to look at them. But in that process, I want you to start asking far deeper questions. What do they represent and what can they teach us? And maybe even what can we teach them whilst they develop? You following?
Absolutely.
It's a pure aesthetic and it's very, very deliberate.
Yeah. And talk to me a little bit about how you capture it, the actual nuts and bolts. What kind of equipment are you using? Because I know you have some older hardware that you use.
It's very, very deliberate. I'm a firm believer in, we always have a translator, but when you get there, you're so remote, the translator can only count and say hi and bye anyway. So it's up to me to communicate. And the only way to communicate is by being utterly, utterly fallible and vulnerable, by metaphorically becoming completely and utterly naked and putting yourself there, by showing enormous passion, enormous eccentricity, lots of yelling and screaming and hand, and then using this stupid old camera. It's very, very cumbersome. Parts of it are 50 years old. The film is very basic. It's very slow. I'm often using shutter speeds of 4 or 5 seconds, standing in a gale on top of a mountain. I'm really going against the grain of what I should be doing. But in that struggle, in that physical, mental, and that emotional struggle, people really see me. They really see I'm desperate to make them icons. I'm desperate to put them on a pedestal, and they give themselves to me. 90% of them aren't necessarily aware of what a camera is. They're also not necessarily aware of what I'm going to do with the pictures. But what they did feel is that, and I'm going to be a bit melodramatic, is that I love them. I thought they were beautiful, and I thought they were amazing, and it's about vanity. And in that process, you end up communicating with them. So that camera was very deliberate. Two sides. One, it forces me to interact. It forces me to communicate. It forces me to make mistakes. It forces me to cry. It forces me to scream, because it's a struggle. Next to that, the end result, and as many photographers will know, film, large format film, is beautiful. It's beautiful. And when you enlarge it, it's full of grain, full of structure, and there's an aesthetic to it that goes far beyond the digitalized pixeled photograph.
And let's talk a little bit about the aesthetic of the books themselves. There's obviously a limited edition, a very extensive, a beautiful book, a huge thing, a real conversation piece.
It's very big. There are 500 of them. It weighs 30 kilos, and it's very expensive.
Well, no, I wanted to ask about that, because it is certainly very expensive. And I wanted to know a little bit about that, whether that is any sort of conflict for you, because obviously I imagine the buyers of this book will likely be rather
the well-heeled, millionaires, perhaps billionaires even. Do you square that with this kind of nakedness, this honesty of your subjects? Do you ever have an issue with that?
I have a massive issue with it, but it's very deliberate again. These beautiful coffee table books, which are selling now, we don't really earn any money doing them. We all know that with books now. They're a business card. It's spreading the project, spreading the imagery, but it's a very, very expensive process where you don't earn any money doing it. The only way I'm ever going to earn money by doing this project, and I need to earn money because I'm wildly in debt because I have an investor who invested in me. Fantastic. I could have never have done this project without him. But it is a business deal. He puts some money in a pot and I have to earn it back. Not only do I have to earn it back, I want to carry on because I become addicted to making these pictures and these people and these experiences. And the only way I'm going to do that is playing on the morality of the richest, most successful people on the planet and saying, reinvest in me. Reinvest some of that wealth you've made in a traditional business. Reinvest that back in the world's last culture and ethnicity. And by do that, you help me create what I hope, without being arrogant, could be a historic document.
And just briefly on that, that investment, I mean, does it actually trickle back to these people? Are they actually invested in the project
investment
as well?
Enables me to pay back my investment, but also enables me to carry on, because my plan is that I will be returning to these people with the book to show them what I've made and take a percentage of the money I've made with me and give it back to them as a gift in kind, in animals. So, yes.
Wonderful stuff. That's Jimmy Nelson. The book is available now, Jimmy.
Online,
now. So you can find out more. It's a fabulous work. And Jimmy, thanks very much for coming to talk to us about
it. Great questions. Thank you for listening. Bye.
And it's back to you in the studio, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom. That was Tom Edwards with the photographer Jimmy Nelson at the Monocle Cafe talking about his book, Before They Pass Away. You can find out more at Jimmy's website, which is beforethey.com. Coming up next, we'll be visiting the fringe of Turin's art world. Stay tuned for more on Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whisky connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whisky. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
The Monocle Book Tour has touched down in the warmer parts of the globe, and this November we'll be packing the snowshoes and chilling out in the Nordic region. Starting on November the 18th in Stockholm and taking in a different country each day, we'll be shooting through Oslo and Copenhagen before ending up in Helsinki on the 21st, and we'll be bringing you live shows right here on Monocle 24 from each stop along the way. So if you want to hear how the Monocle Guide to Better Living is going down in the snowier parts of Europe, point your mouse towards book.monocle.com and be sure to tune in to Nordic Leg of the Monocle Book Tour this November on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Muller. We're heading now to Turin, where last week much of the international art market's attention was on the international art fair Artissima, taking place in the suitably regenerated Linjotto area of this automotive centre. We dropped in on Artissima's fringe event, Paratissima, which now in its fifth year has become Italy's most visited contemporary art event. Monocle's David Pleasant caught up with Alessandro Stilo, curator and creative director of Paratissima, and asked him about how young artists might thrive even in Italy's current worse-than-usual economic chaos.
Paratissima is the fringe of Artissima, totally independent fringe. That's why the name is Paratissima, something that is not exactly Artissima, but is para, is around, it's at the side of Artissima, and is a totally independent event that offer the opportunity to exhibit to 600 artists, especially from the region, but not only.
And we're here just the other side of the railway tracks across this bridge that was built for the Olympics. We can see Artissima the other side of the tracks. And when you arrive here, it's a very different feeling, as you've explained. It's a fringe event for predominantly local artists. What are you trying to sell the artists that take part? But what's in it for them?
Well, you know, first of all, Paratissima is an opportunity, nothing more than an opportunity. With €50, £40, you can exhibit your own art. Second, real point is not that you pay, but is that you pay and so you feel that the event is yours. It's not an event that some other person organized for you, but the event that you organize. This is, I think, is the big difference from us and Artissima. Our budget is 10%, maybe less, of Artissima. And, I mean, we don't have problem in that sense. We do an exhibition dedicated to the people. At the same time, we have many sections. And in the sections, in the special activities, special projects, there are very good artists, very well-known artists. Starting from this year, we have GAP, that means Galleries at Paratissima, where we have 10 galleries that sell artworks that cost less than €5,000. So it's an offer to young artists, to people that make art.
You mentioned before we were walking around something of the curatorial help, the tuition, that the kind of the school that you're running here, and how fundamentally you might tell the artists, the exhibitors, what to do, but there's no kind of intervention. Everyone's free to do what they want at the end of the day. Would you agree? Is that difficult, that kind of process? You, as somebody involved in the arts, do you find it a challenge to let these people just exhibit however they want? What are the challenges there?
Well, it's really a challenge. Why? Because it's easier to say you must do that. I mean, to be a boss, it's difficult for one side, but it's very easy for the other side. But this is not the philosophy of Paratissima. The idea is to make a point with the artist. They are free to don't follow our suggestion. What we are trying to do is to transform Paratissima in an organized chaos from a chaos. So we don't want to become the best organized event in the world. We want to help the artists to understand what is best for their artworks and for their own. So this is a dialogue. It's very, very challenging. It's very, very tiring, because 600 artists, we are a big staff, but the artistical staff, the artistic direction is 15 people. So we have to discuss with 100 artists each day. But this is how you can build an event with the people, not for the people.
Finally, if we can open up, look outside these walls, this complex, and talk about Turin and Italy and the contemporary art more widely. Italy obviously has a huge presence on the contemporary art scene still, but do you see a disconnect between perhaps the opportunities for young artists, or do you think it's always been a struggle and it always will be? What's the current situation, do you think, if you are a young, aspiring contemporary artist here in Italy? How would you paint that picture?
Well, Italy has a large, huge scene of artists and of young artists. This is a good point. During last 15 years, more than in many other European countries, especially the cities and the regions, dedicated money and activities to offer opportunity to young people to become young artists. This is a good point. Italy hasn't a real art market. Doesn't exist a real large art market. This is not a good point. So, third point, today energy, the money of the local authorities that are very important in Italy. Italy is the country of the 5,000 cities and little town and so on. The money is over. So this is not a good moment, but at the same time, many of the biggest ideas in art became in a crisis moment. Post-war was fantastic for UK, for Italy, for Germany, for many other countries, for Balkans now. So the problem is the conscience that you have to make your own way.
David Pleasant there, reporting from Turin. You're listening to Aperitivo on Monocle 24. Time now for some music, and staying with the art-related theme established by the previous item, this is Primitive Painters by Felt.
Thank you.
Primitive Painters by the scandalously underrated Felt, featuring the scandalously underrated Lawrence Later of the scandalously underrated Denim. You see the pattern emerging across Lawrence's career there. You are listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We are approaching the end of the programme, but before we get there, we're going to have a look at what else is coming up on Monocle 24 tonight. And I'm joined now by Alad John and Barbara Feeney, who are producing, respectively, the next two programmes. Alad, you're producing Globalist Asia.
Yes, indeed.
Which is, well, it's not next. It's happening in an hour and 5 minutes.
So just over an hour's time.
So yeah. You hopefully have some idea at this point what's on the programme.
No idea. No idea.
Really? It's the Globo Asia lucky dip tonight.
No, there's actually, as you can imagine, some very big Asia stories at the moment, not least the crisis in the Philippines in the wake of the locally named Yolanda super typhoon. We're going to look at how the international community is galvanising a relief effort, looking also particularly at how that relief will be implemented. So we're going to hear from the Vice Consul to the UK, to the United Kingdom, a guy called Mr. Romel Romato. He is the Vice Consul for the Philippines to the United Kingdom. We're going to speak to him about how the steps being taken by both the Philippines and the international community are going to be implemented locally.
There's also there's a fairly big Filipino community in the United Kingdom, about 100,000 people, I believe, who he must be fielding all sorts of calls from.
Well, it was difficult to get hold of him. Yes,
I would think.
Yeah, but that is actually an element of what we're going to look at. We're going to look at how remittances might play a part in the international relief effort. Huge expat community across the world, obviously, not least in the UK, America, a massive community there, Beirut as well. Yeah, we're going to be fleshing out how they are going to be reacting to the news there and also the relief effort.
And what else do you have on the show?
So then we're going to turn our eye to another part of Asia, to a few media stories. One in China that Bloomberg have reportedly, this comes from an anonymous source in Bloomberg, they've been self-censoring their stories. They had two big stories which would have shone a limelight, a slightly negative light on the Communist Party, and they took the decision to pull those stories as a means of staying put in the country. We're going to look at that.
It's an interesting question, because a degree of that goes on, I suspect, in every media organisation in the world.
Well, exactly. And I mean, within the last year, the New York Times supposedly had their journalists turfed out of the country for alleging connection between Xi Jinping's family and big contractors. So it's a dangerous place to be a journalist if you want to be bringing those big stories to the limelight. Then we're also going to turn to Japan, where the Liberal Democratic Party have proposed a bill which will dish out very, very strong penalties to public servants who are leaking information. So we've spoken to our Tokyo Bureau Chief, and then we're going to round up a kind of view of the worst offenders against the media in Asia with Somnath Batyabal of London SOAS. So, yeah, it should be an interesting little segment.
That's the Globalist Asia at 2000 hours. Barbara Feeney producing The Daily at 2200 hours London time. What's coming up?
Well, Andrew, we are starting off. We're going to discuss the EU-US trade talks, which began in Brussels today, and they were delayed because of the US government shutdown. And then there was obviously kind of further delays because of the allegations over spying. So they're starting today, and we're going to kind of ask what this could mean, particularly kind of from a US point of view, what it would mean, because it would be the world's biggest free trade deal if it did go ahead. And obviously there's a lot of things to discuss and a lot of hurdles to kind of overcome. So it'll be quite an interesting discussion, because if it does get implemented, it would be...
It'd be interesting as well to see how much getting beaten up on over the whole spying thing the US has to put up with before they can actually start talking to people.
And last week, John Kerry did say that they should just kind of try and leave that behind them and get on with the discussion. Yeah. But
then he would.
He would.
And just briefly, what else is coming up on The Daily?
We are also going to look ahead to Sunday's presidential elections in Chile. We are going to kind of follow up on what they're doing on the Globalist Asia and look at the expat Filipino population in New York and see what they're doing. And finally, we're going to talk to the editor of the Castine Patriot. And do you know where that is?
I wouldn't know where to start guessing.
Well, you can wait and listen to the show.
I shall do exactly that, Alad John, Barbara Feeney. Thank you both very much for joining me. That is all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. This week is the final week of season one of Aperitivo. Season two will return sometime in the new year. My thanks in particular to our special guests this evening, Jeffrey Kaufman of ABC News, Alessio Patilano of King's College London. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Firminich and Matt Alagaya, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips. Aperitivo will return at the same time tomorrow at 1600 London time, but for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.